Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. Today we open with national stories from Public News Service, followed by a report from La Mesa's lively town hall meeting, including the city's response to police use of force against a handcuffed student at Helix High, as well as residents concerned about homelessness, marijuana, and more. Hear about homeless sweeps in rural Ramona and a report on the impacts of rising housing costs statewide. On sports, hear about some talented East County athletes being honored by the San Diego Hall of Champions. On Tribal Beat, we'll have info on the new Willows Hotel at the Viejas Resort, which is creating hundreds of new jobs in Alpine. On Crime Beat, a flasher wearing nothing but a red t-shirt and sheer black tights has been reported near Parkway Plaza. Next, find out where you can get free blood pressure and heart health screenings this month. On the second half of today's show, we'll replay two of our favorite episodes, an interview with Ramona wildlife photographer Roy Toft on animal tales, and on Wildest Jobs, a talk with Ramona's rodeo clown. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Monday, February the 12th, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. Groups call a disabilities bill pending in Congress an attack on civil rights. Also on today's Nationwide Rundown, we'll tell you about a new website that tracks government attacks on climate science, and we examine whether meat is the next target for a sin tax. First, our top story, New York's Attorney General put the brakes on the sale of the Weinstein Company over the weekend. The New York Times reports A.G. Schneiderman filed suit against the movie studio and the Weinstein brothers, alleging they violated state and city laws barring gender discrimination, sexual harassment, sexual abuse, and coercion. The suit puts on hold a proposed sale that was to be finalized on Sunday. In a release statement, Schneiderman said any sale of the Weinstein Company must ensure that victims will be compensated and employees protected going forward. For his part, Harvey Weinstein has denied all allegations of non-consensual sex. A bill aimed at strengthening the Americans with Disabilities Act may not be what it seems, Mary Sherman explains.
The U.S. House could vote this week on the ADA Education and Reform Act of 2017, which would give businesses accused of not complying with the law a grace period to fix alleged infractions on their properties before they are subject to litigation. Proponents claim it will curb frivolous lawsuits, but Marilyn Golden with the Disability Rights and Education Fund argues most lawsuits filed under the ADA are not about money, but instead well-intentioned efforts to make buildings more accessible.
If this bill passed, it would be very, very damaging for the civil rights of people with disabilities. It would mean businesses had no incentive to comply voluntarily with the law. Businesses could just take a wait-and-see attitude.
ADA enforcement essentially relies on people with disabilities challenging violations. Golden says the legislation would complicate the complaint process and greatly lengthen the time it takes to bring a business into compliance. The House could vote on the bill as early as Wednesday.
The ADA has been the law for 28 years, which Golden says means businesses have had ample time to understand the law's requirements and comply. And a lawsuit has been filed in federal court challenging what advocates say is the targeting of immigrants' rights activists by federal immigration officials.
Last month, Ravi Ragbir, who heads the New Sanctuary Coalition, was detained during a routine check-in with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. A federal court ordered his release, but he was told to report for deportation last Saturday. Other immigrant rights activists have had similar encounters with ICE. William Perdue, an attorney with the law firm Arnold & Porter, says on Friday the leaders of several organizations joined Ragbir in filing the lawsuit seeking to make the deportations stop.
Our clients, including Mr. Ragbir, have spoken out about U.S. immigration law and policy, and the immigration authorities have retaliated against them by detaining or seeking to deport them, and the First Amendment prohibits that.
Federal immigration officials have denied targeting immigrants for deportation based on their advocacy work, but they have agreed not to deport Ragbir at this time. I'm Andrea Sears reporting.
Alarmed over what they see as the government's growing hostility towards science, Mark Richardson reports groups at Columbia Law School have created an online database that tracks attempts to discredit or censor climate scientists.
The Sabin Center for Climate Change Law and the Climate Science Legal Defense Fund jointly developed the Silencing Science Tracker to chronicle media reports on government attempts to restrict or prevent scientific research, education, discussion, or the publication or use of scientific information since the November 2016 election. Romani Webb with the Center for Climate Change Law says they became concerned after Scott Pruitt, an avowed climate denier, was named to head the Environmental Protection Agency.
It was really prompted by our observations of the Trump administration, primarily out of the EPA's decision to disallow agency-funded or government-funded scientists serving on the agency's scientific advisory board.
She says the database went live last month on the anniversary of President Donald Trump's inauguration. The list of reports is updated daily and, she adds, is growing rapidly. Webb says since Trump took office, they've seen the EPA carry out numerous actions to counter its own scientists, weakening their ability to continue their research or inform the public discourse on climate change.
And finally, Roz Brown reports animal rights advocates say the time is right for Americans who choose a meat-based diet to pay taxes on both the production and consumption of meat-based products.
The countries of Denmark, Germany, and Sweden have floated taxes on meat, but they have yet to gain traction. Ashley Byrne with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals says while there are no current legislative proposals in the U.S., she believes behavioral or excise taxes on beef, pork, and chicken could encourage people to modify their eating habits. She says if we accept that it's okay to tax tobacco, alcohol, and in some cities soda because of their negative health impacts, meat belongs in the same category.
PETA has been calling for a sin tax or an excise tax on meat for a very long time, but recently the idea really seems to have picked up steam with the public.
In a state such as South Dakota, which reported 4 million cattle and 260,000 sheep last year, a meat tax may be a non-starter.
While some health experts do endorse meat in various amounts, almost none endorse the quantity Americans currently eat. The average U.S. citizen consumes more than 200 pounds of meat each year. That is twice the global average. That's our news for now. I'm Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
This is Miriam Raftery with a local government report from La Mesa. La Mesa held a lively town hall meeting last week at Northmont Elementary School, where many residents spoke out to voice concerns on a range of issues. La Mesa is unique among East County cities in holding town halls each year. Unlike city council meetings, town hall formats allow council members, the mayor, and city staff to respond directly to public comments, resulting in productive interaction between residents and city officials. The hottest topic raised by many residents was the use of force by a La Mesa police officer against a handcuffed female student at Helix Charter High School recently. At the start of the meeting, City Manager Yvonne Garrett said the city has determined that the best course of action is to engage the services of a third party who will conduct an independent inquiry into whether the officer's action breached protocol. La Mesa Chief of Police Walt Vasquez was called up by the mayor to answer questions from students. The chief promised that all of La Mesa's police officers are about to receive de-escalation training based on a new California law requiring that. Mayor Mark Arapostathis, who is also a teacher, assured those with concerns that no matter what conclusions the investigation reaches, he believes changes are going to happen, adding that changes in training are being discussed at every school to take action in the best interest of students. Councilwoman Christine Alicio suggested reviving the city's Human Relations Commission, adding, "Our city doesn't want people to feel vulnerable." And she said, "Going forward, we're going to take all the steps we can to make sure this doesn't happen again." Aramik Mika, an activist who organized a student walkout at Helix in protest after the incident, noted that a grand jury previously recommended the city create a Community Relations Commission, and she urged the council to do so now. Mika pressed the mayor on why, 19 days after the incident, the city still hasn't launched the independent inquiry. City staff said that interviews have been completed and a decision should be made by late Monday on who will conduct the independent review. The police officer has been placed on administrative leave, pending the outcome of an investigation. Other issues raised by community members at the La Mesa Town Hall included homelessness, concerns over a new drug rehab facility in a residential neighborhood, marijuana, and increased airplane noise from air traffic into Lindbergh Field that's been rerouted over La Mesa and nearby East County communities. The mayor said he's been in discussions with Lemon Grove and the Federal Aviation Administration regarding the growing noise complaints. Half a dozen speakers voiced concerns over homelessness, including a social worker, who noted that the cost of housing is out of control while services are inadequate throughout the county. She asked what the city council plans to do to address the root causes of homelessness instead of issuing nuisance citations. Councilman Colin Parent agreed that homelessness is a serious issue and said he participated in the homeless count in January. He notes that the city recently joined the regional continuum of care, as a grand jury had recommended, and that La Mesa has adopted affordability bonuses. He and Councilmember Alicio also recently formed a housing affordability subcommittee. Councilman Guy McWherter said homelessness is like a hydra. It has so many different heads, including causes such as mental illness as well as finances. He wants to see the county step up to the plate and do more. McWherter added that he's worked to help homeless for decades at centers such as Father Joe's Village and the East County Transitional Living Center in El Cajon. As for the drug rehab centers popping up in La Mesa, the city attorney explained that for facilities licensed by the state of California for six or fewer residents, the city's hands are tied, despite residents' concerns about safety, traffic, and neighborhood character. But Councilmember Alicio said she has served as a liaison in a similar situation and offered to help residents negotiate with the facility. Mayor Rapostathis added that he's had talks with Assemblywoman Shirley Weber on whether legislation at the state level could address the issue. Some residents did offer praise for the city and its handling of crimes, as well as shutting down illegal marijuana dispensaries in neighborhoods. Another resident voiced concern over odors from a neighbor's marijuana plants. The city attorney clarified that although Proposition 64 legalized growing up to six marijuana plants per household, La Mesa has outlawed outdoor growing, and the resident was encouraged to call code enforcement.
Ramona residents recently held community meetings to discuss their vision for creating a trail system and greenbelt along Santa Maria Creek. But the creek bed has become a center for homeless encampments, which sheriff's deputies are now aggressively working to clear, the Ramona Sentinel reports. Homelessness is a growing problem countywide. Rooted out of urban areas, many homeless people have set up camps along rivers and creeks. Those camps are now found not only in urban hubs such as Mission Valley, but also in San Diego's rural and mountain areas. On January 16th, deputies walked the creek bed in Ramona to warn hundreds of homeless people that they are trespassing and must move elsewhere. Deputies provided the homeless with information on how to apply for housing, food stamps, mental health, and substance abuse programs. Deputies also posted signs warning of future enforcement action. According to Sergeant Rob Samuels, deputies also found illegal fires, trash dumping, and human waste along the creek. A follow-up inspection on January 30th, along with representatives from county code enforcement and the county's health and human services, found a dozen or so occupants who had not relocated. Some accepted help offered, but others did not, according to law enforcement. Sheriff's deputies plan to hold sweeps in the near future to clear the Santa Maria Creek. The department is asking for community volunteers to assist with cleanup of trash afterwards, and the sheriff's Ramona substation will provide security. Anyone willing to help should call Deputy Landon Kuhn at 760-789-9157. That's 760-789-9157. The conflict in rural Ramona highlights the need for the county to step up and provide additional resources to house homeless people and provide services to reduce homelessness, as some communities in the region are now doing. Despite growing homelessness, the county of San Diego still does not operate a single homeless shelter of its own, instead conducting sweeps to force homeless people out of the unincorporated areas into other communities to seek shelter. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Paul Cruz.
The Golden State is generating jobs that pay well, but has one of the lowest home ownership rates in the country, according to a new report. The 16th annual Prosperity Now scorecard shows California slipped slightly from 26th in the nation to 27th, as ranked by 58 measures of prosperity and 63 policies that could help people improve their prosperity. The report says sky-high housing costs affect minority communities most, with 65% of California's African-American renters and 60% of Latino renters spending more than 30% of their income on housing. Study co-author Solana Rice suggests the state pass a law that prevents landlords from refusing to take renters who rely on Section 8 housing vouchers.
So we call that source of income discrimination. And right now, California allows that. And so we really recommend that the state look into protecting renters from that kind of discrimination.
Only 53% of Californians own homes. The report says that's the third lowest rate in the nation. On other measures, the state looks pretty good. Unemployment is at a record low, and California is 10th in the nation for having the lowest rate of low-wage jobs, an improvement from 18th last year. Rice notes the Trump administration and Congress have dealt several major blows to low-income people in the last year. She thinks their vote to repeal the individual health insurance mandate will prompt many healthy people to opt out of the system. She warns that would drive up insurance prices, putting coverage out of reach for low-income families.
We expect many, many to lose health care coverage because of that, about 9 million people over the next decade nationwide. And that also affects budgets eventually, so every state will be impacted.
Rice adds the new tax overhaul in the long term amounts to a major redistribution of wealth from low and middle income families to the top 1% of taxpayers and to corporations. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This is Gene Carpenter with a sports report from East County Magazine on KNSJ. The San Diego Hall of Champions has named several East County athletes as its stars for the month of January, the organization announced this week. Born and raised in Ramona, figure skater Chris Neerum and his wife Alexa are currently representing the U.S. at the Olympics in South Korea. The pair skating team nailed a quad twist to win the U.S. figure skating pairs championships last month. Jenna Buth, a senior on San Diego State University's women's tennis team, posted a perfect record in both singles and doubles. She won matches against UCSD and UC Irvine before teaming up with Paula Diaz to sweep in two doubles matches, also earning the Mountain West Player of the Year honors. Tayshawn Cherry, a boys basketball player at Foothills Christian School in East County, was also honored. He posted a spotless 10-0 record for the month. The number one member of the school's team, he stands 6'10" tall, averages over 25 points and more, and 13 rebounds per game, helping the Foothills Knights move to 21-5 for the season.
This is the East County Magazine Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities.
This is Gene Carpenter with East County Magazine's Tribal Beat Report. At the grand opening of the Willows Hotel and Spa, a luxury high-rise at the Viejas Casino and Resort in Alpine, Tribal Chairman Robert Welch reflectively told the crowd to put on your sunglasses because the future of Viejas has never looked brighter. The Willows features a hotel tower with 159 king and queen suites, a saltwater swimming pool, spa and salon facilities, restaurants, a fitness center, and a business center. The all-adults facility also features Alexa personal electronic assistants in each room that can answer questions, order a wake-up call, or play music when paired with a smartphone. New restaurants include Ginger Noodle Bar, which serves up Asian cuisine, and Locale, a farm-to-table restaurant offering international cuisine made with local ingredients and a coffee bar. General Manager Todd Simon spoke at the grand opening ceremony. He praised the tribe for generously giving back to the community through their business ventures, which now include two hotels, a casino, and an outlet shopping center. Viejas has generously funded fire protection and medical services in our region, as well as toy drives for children in need and more. The Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation now employs over 2,000 team members and is holding 20 job fairs to fill the many jobs being created at the new hotel, spa, and restaurants. The tribe has outreached in its recruitment to institutions ranging from San Diego State University to a culinary institute and an organization that helps place disabled individuals. Tribal Chairman Robert Welch voiced pride in his team, which he likened to a willow tree.
flexible, yet with strength in the roots, helping to turn the tribe's latest dream into reality. When someone tells you why it can't be done, it's a reflection on their limitations, he concluded, adding, "The future is not something we enter, it's something we create." With that, he cut a red ribbon to officially open the Willows Hotel and Spa, after which a crowd of VIPs enjoyed a dazzling fireworks show to celebrate the tribe's newest creation.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Paul Cruz with a Crime Beat report. A man in a vehicle parked outside Parkway Plaza shopping mall in El Cajon reportedly exposed himself to a 14-year-old girl on Tuesday in broad daylight. The girl was seated in a car waiting for her mother to get off work at the Home Goods store. The girl's mother, Alexis Napier, told 10 News that the man put his legs on the dashboard and spread them apart while staring at her daughter. The man wore only a red t-shirt and sheer black nylon tights. The girl told her mother that the man got out of the car and started doing stretches, thrusting his hips forward. He also walked around and bent over and exposed his genitals and rump. The teenager put a blanket up to block the unwanted view. When the mother came out of the store, the man took off in his vehicle. The mother called 911 and followed the suspect a short distance to get his license plate number. Police are reportedly investigating. Posts on the Mount Helix Next Door forum indicate the flasher is a white man in his 30s or 40s driving a burgundy Ford Edge with Mickey Mouse stickers on it. Anyone with information on this incident should contact the El Cajon Police Department.
Valentine's Day is the perfect time to show your heart a little love. The County of San Diego's annual Love Your Heart Day event takes place on Wednesday, February 14th at more than 150 sites in San Diego County and allows adults to get a free blood pressure screening. The event, now in its seventh year, is part of the county's Live Well San Diego vision. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States and the second leading cause of death in San Diego County. Obesity, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, and a family history of heart disease can put an individual at greater risk of heart disease. Getting a blood pressure check is a simple step to take for heart health. Last year's Love Your Heart event helped over 53,000 people get to know their blood pressure numbers and take charge of their own heart health. Over 10% of those screened last year, that's more than 5,300 people, had an elevated blood pressure level, and 77 of them were identified with urgent or emergent hypertension. For a list of Love Your Heart event locations locally, you can call 211 or check the interactive map at the San Diego County News Center's website. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fisteer.
You're listening to KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
For the second half of our show today, we'll be airing some of our Best of East County favorite episodes.
Welcome, this is Mimi Pollack, host of East County Magazine's Animal Tales. Welcome to Animal Tales. This is Mimi Pollack. I am here today with Ramona wildlife photographer Roy Tuft. Not only is he a renowned photographer with pictures appearing in National Geographic magazine, he also offers guided tours to Africa, Costa Rica, and Alaska. Tuft got his degree as a wildlife biologist, so the focus of these tours is showing you how to photograph indigenous wildlife while having adventures in the wild. Welcome, Roy.
Thanks for having me, Mimi. Happy to be here.
How did you get into wildlife photography?
Well, I was the crazy kid in Poway with the garage full of snakes, right? So right away, everybody knew I loved animals. And so I grew up loving animals, getting out in our local chaparral and watching the hawks and catching snakes and enjoying that. Went on to get a wildlife degree from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo in Northern California, and got my first camera as I graduated from college and started taking pictures of what I loved.
What type of camera was it?
It was a Canon AE-1, which was kind of a classic old film camera.
And so the camera inspired you to start taking pictures and combining both the wildlife degree along with the photography.
Yeah, I mean, it's always the animals that were the major interest, and the photography is kind of a stimulus to get you out there, right? And it keeps you out there longer. So it's just kind of a natural thing to want to enjoy your subjects more. You can take images of them and enjoy them when you're back home.
And besides Costa Rica and Alaska, what countries have you been to in Africa, and what other countries have you been to in the world where you've done wildlife photography?
Wow, good question. I've been to, I should count the number of countries I've been to, but in the last 30 years of doing wildlife photography, I've been pretty much all over the world, from Antarctica to Japan and Indonesia and Australia, New Zealand, most of the countries in Africa and Central and South America. So yeah, I guess it'd be easier to say very few places I haven't been at this point.
And after college, how did you move into becoming more of a professional wildlife photographer?
Well, right after college, I started working at the Wild Animal Park here in San Diego. I guess now it's called the Zufari Park, which is always hard for me to remember. And I was doing the bird show there, and it's kind of a, I think anybody that's been in San Diego for a while knows that bird show. It's been there for 30 years, so I was happy that they asked me to join them there at the bird show. And being at the Wild Animal Park every day, doing my job at the bird show, of course, I'm surrounded by beautiful wildlife, even though it's, you know, it's not really wild, but it gave me an opportunity to get out during breaks and lunch hours with my camera and start taking imagery and work on it and get better at it. And so that really got me going into wildlife photography.
And how did you get connected to National Geographic magazine?
One of my last years working at the park, we had a National Geographic photographer come to the park doing a story on new zoos. And his name was Michael Nick Nichols, really a world-renowned photographer who's done dozens and dozens of stories for National Geographic. Well, everybody at the park knew I was into photography pretty heavily at that point. So they asked Nick if he needed an assistant, and I helped him on that new zoos project. So that kind of got me, you know, a little bit in working with National Geographic. And a couple years later, I went and did a 2-year project with Nick on tigers that we spent 2 years photographing wild tigers. And that was kind of the start of my career and a wonderful, you know, mentorship for me to be working with such a well-known and terrific photographer as Nick.
Okay. Tell me more about those 2 years photographing tigers. For example, what exactly did you do while you were there? How did you help Nick? And do you have any memorable moment or story that you can tell us from those years?
Sure. Yeah. So we were working in India, which has the largest population of tigers. And a big part of the story, of course, is doing a natural history portion of the project. So we spent over 2 years photographing a female tiger raising cubs. And so we basically go out every day at 4:30 in the morning on elephant back, because that's the easiest and most accessible way to be close to tigers, is to be on top of an animal that they're not really that nervous about. 7 days a week for 3 months per trip to India. So we did 3 of those for the natural history portion. And we were photographing tigers, and we'd spend about 10 hours a day in the field and only see tigers about every 5 days on average. So it was a lot of time in the field for very little, you know, return, but it was definitely worth it.
But didn't you also do some groundbreaking work with remote cameras?
Yes, Nick was just really pushing the limits with remote cameras in the field, and tigers being a difficult animal to photograph in person and at close range. He set up 7 remote cameras in the jungle with my help. And my main job was to keep those remote cameras running 24/7. A remote camera, if you don't know, is a system where there's an infrared beam, and the animal basically breaks that beam and takes his own picture. And that allowed us to take wide angle, very intimate shots of tigers that have never been done before. And that was one of our main ways of getting that kind of unique imagery of tigers while we were there.
That sounds very interesting. I imagine you must have gotten some incredible photographs with the remote cameras. Is there any one particular picture that you remember that comes to mind? Or
yeah, actually, for the listeners at home, if you have kind of that stack of National Geographic magazines on your library wall, it's 1997 December is the cover issue, and one of the pictures in there was a 50-page story, so it was a huge Nat Geo article. One of the pictures, I placed a camera on a vertical dry waterfall, so it's a rock wall. And we had seen a male tiger jump that chasm in where the water would be running if it was actually wet, and to get to another water source. And so we put this camera, set it up so he's jumping right into a 20 millimeter wide lens, which is a very unique perspective. And that camera was there for 3 months, and we had one picture from that 3 months, and it's in the issue, and it's amazing, a male tiger jumping right into the camera midair. So it's wow. one of those, pictures you never get in person. You'd have to kind of use this system of remote cameras. And it's much more common nowadays. But when Nick did it and we did it for the Tiger Project, it was really revolutionary.
I remember that issue. It was just amazing. Yeah. Now tell me about a memorable moment.
Another memorable moment with tigers is, as I mentioned earlier, we spent a lot of time in elephants following tigers and photographing them, straight and not with a remote camera. Well, at one time, Nick was on one elephant, I was on another elephant, and we have our mahouts, or our drivers, driving the elephants, and we had this one male tiger named Charger that was in this tall grass, and we backed our elephants into the grass to be able to photograph from a perspective down into the grass, and obviously went too close to the tiger as he was feeling pressured. He came up on the back of Nick's elephant. Actually jumped onto the rear of the elephant.
Wow.
Which was exciting for everyone, especially the elephants. so the elephants just started spinning and screaming, and we, Nick and I held on for dear life,
and they rotated fast.
Yes, they just spun, just like tornadoes, and just sent the tiger flying, and it was quite an exciting moment. Like most things with wildlife photography, when instances like this happen, it's usually because we do something wrong, and it was obviously our fault. We pushed we asked the elephants to get too close to the tiger, and he just did what was natural for a tiger, which is, get out of here. And of course, he did it in a very traumatic fashion.
That was probably scary and exciting at the same time.
Yeah, certainly.
And then when you finished with doing the tiger shoot, what was the next project you worked on?
Well, after the tiger project, I came home and rested for a while because that was a long project. I actually did an assignment for Audubon magazine where I went and photographed ocelots in Texas. And it's another cat, a smaller spotted cat. And a lot of people don't know we have ocelots in the United States.
I didn't know that. Ocelots in Texas. What part of Texas?
Yeah, this was in near Laguna Atascosa. So it's way, way south Texas. The majority of ocelots are found in Central and South America. So this is just kind of a small population coming up into Texas.
Are they endangered?
They are endangered. There's only about 50 ocelots left in Texas in the United States. And so, yeah, I was also using remote cameras again to photograph this elusive cat.
And then what was your next big shoot after that?
Wow. Next big shoot after that. I did another project for Audubon on a rainforest photography and birds. So that was another cover story for Audubon magazine.
I remember you told me about wolves, that you did something up in Alaska with wolves.
Yeah, right out of college, as I mentioned, I was a wildlife biology major, and right out of college, I did a wolf population study up in Alaska for the summer. It was, merely a 3-month project putting collars on wolves so we could do a population study. So that was my first time in the field with my new camera, so that was kind of an exciting time for me.
And then also for, I believe it was 3 years, you and your wife opened up a gallery up in Solana Beach on Cedros Avenue, right?
Yeah, we had a beautiful gallery on Cedros in Solana Beach, and it was my wife's idea to kind of show my art to people and be able to have a gallery, and it was fun. We did that and met a lot of local people. It was when we first moved back to San Diego. In the early 2000s, we moved back in 2005.
Where did you live before then?
We were up in the Bay Area for about 8 years, up in Half Moon Bay on the coast south of San Francisco.
But you are a local San Diego boy, right? Where did you grow up?
Yeah, I actually grew up in Poway, So we moved to Poway in 1970. Yeah, I grew up here, went to high school here, went off to college in Northern California, and then we moved around a bit and then came back to kind of the motherland here in Ramona in 2005.
What do you like about living in Ramona?
We love the wilderness experience we have in Ramona. You know, we live on big acreage, which you can still find here in the East County, which is great. And so it's peaceful.
How many acres?
We have 40 acres.
Wow.
Yeah, and nice. It's in kind of the big boulder country up there near Mount Woodson, so it's beautiful. Lots of local wildlife. You know, I don't always have to jump on an airplane to get my camera out and photograph wildlife. In fact, this last week, I've spent every morning in a blind photographing our small indigenous fox, our California gray fox, something that actually I've spent no time photographing fox all my years here. They're kind of a tough animal to see. We often see coyotes a lot more, but this is a little bit smaller canid that is more nocturnal, quite a bit more elusive than coyotes. And they're just beautiful. They have a gray color with a cinnamon rust on the chest and their shoulders. Gorgeous, big, fluffy tail. And this week I was sitting in a blind photographing a den with five kits, and that's what they call young foxes. So what a great, you know, here I am in my backyard. I got my coffee and I walk across the valley, get in my blind and photograph beautiful foxes right here in San Diego County.
I know, I've seen the pictures. They're amazing. Now, you mentioned to me earlier that you have a teaching credential and you enjoy working with people. And so you mentioned to me that in the year 2000, you started organizing photographic expeditions where you would take people to different countries and teach them how to photograph wildlife. Tell us more about that.
Sure. Yeah, that's a big part of my business now is leading photographic tours or safaris. And, you know, it's never a better time than now to take photos. You know, the digital era and digital cameras have made it so much more accessible for people. You know, you're not spending a ton of money on film. You know, you're getting instant feedback from these little TV screens, so you can really progress much quicker than the old days with film. And so, you know, people are finding they want to go out instead of going on a typical vacation and going to some beach and sitting on the beach or going golfing, that there's this whole other avenue for vacations. And, you know, you can combine wildlife viewing, traveling, and learning, you know, something new and exciting. And that's what I do in these wildlife tours. You know, I bring people to Africa or Brazil or Alaska for bears or Mexico, and Costa Rica is one of my all-time favorite destinations. It's close and you have a rainforest right there. So it's a wonderful way to get people out in the field and, you know, try out a new camera, or if they're already an experienced photographer, it's wonderful to go with a pro that already gives you, taking you to the best spots and the best lodges. And so that's a big part of my business. In fact, this year I'll be in the field 160 days running my photo tours.
For those of you who just tuned in, this is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, East County Magazine. Now, I want to go into more detail about these trips. For example, what countries do you go to in Africa?
My main country I go to in Africa is Botswana, a lovely country. It's just north of South Africa, so it's in the southern part of the continent, and I've been going there. This will be my 14th year leading tours to Botswana, so obviously I love it. It's spectacular wildlife. Most people perhaps have heard of the Okavango Delta, which is a very well-known area. It's a floodplain and a desert that creates this oasis for wildlife. And so that's my main destination. Although I have to say next week, I'm going to Tanzania in East Africa, leading a photo trip there. So a couple different countries in Africa I go to.
Getting back to Botswana, do some people go there because of the books, the number one ladies detective agency? Do they ever go there and ask you about that? Or?
Yeah, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. I mean, people who go to Botswana, of course, have read those books because it's such an interesting series. And it's based in Botswana. I don't think it's the reason they go, obviously, because it's really the wildlife that brings them there. But it's a nice connection.
Yeah. And when people go to Africa, they must think that, you know, they're going to be roughing it. Or why don't you tell us, because I remember you mentioned to me that you want people to know that going to Africa is not going to be roughing it, that it's actually going to be a very pleasant experience in terms of lodging and food and how they take care of you. Why don't you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I get that a lot, Mimi. I get, isn't it dangerous and aren't you afraid going to Africa? And I think so much of the media reports of, they generalize when they're speaking of the entire continent of Africa, when there's, there's epidemics of something going on or a little bit of violence somewhere. It's a huge continent. And, we're going to a place that's very safe. In fact, the most dangerous part of your African safari will be driving to the airport here in Limburg Field. I mean, being in your car statistically is more dangerous than any other part of the trip. And we're taken care of. It's just really amazing the service level that we get on, in our trips to Africa, the lodging, the food, the wine. Yeah, everything is 5-star. So there's absolutely no roughing it. I have clients that are kind of wonder what big hiking boots they should buy to bring on my trip. And I have to tell them that, I wear Crocs, the most comfortable light slip-on shoe, because we're in vehicles all day. We're not going on death marches. We're not hiking. We're driving around in wonderful vehicles and viewing this wildlife very close and photographing it and then going back for wonderful dinners and wonderful lodging. So it's nothing that you have to worry about roughing it. It's very much a luxury vacation.
I've also heard that the African people themselves are very friendly and very welcoming.
They really are. They are just over the top friendly, just smiles from ear to ear at all times. And so it's a wonderful cultural experience. People that just don't get to travel that much, if it's based on fear, get out there and see some other places around the world, because people are people. And when you go to these communities, they're just so welcoming. And, it's such a joy to see people from around the world and get a different perspective. If you're just always in one location, it's tough to view the world in more than one perspective. So yeah, get out there and travel and see the world and see some beautiful places. That's what I like to do.
Now, what about for the more outdoorsy types, the ones that want to go hiking, the ones that want to have more of an outdoor adventure? What country would you recommend that they take a photographic tour with you, but to where? Like, for somebody who's more of an outdoorsy hiking.
Yeah, if you don't want to be in a vehicle the entire time and you want to get out and physically, hike and enjoy the environment. I actually have several that do that. Costa Rica is a great one. It's close. It's an easy flight. Within 6 hours, you're in prime rainforest and seeing, 4 species of monkeys and tropical birds, toucans and parrots. It's really mind-boggling, in this day and age. You can just get away for 6-8 hours and you're in this amazing tropical environment. So that's one we definitely get out and hike and experience that rainforest. As I mentioned earlier, I was just in Chile photographing pumas, our mountain lion, same cat. And it's possible there to photograph them on foot. And so we do a lot of hiking in Torres de Peña National Park in Chile. So that's definitely high up. People really want to get their heart rate up and do some hiking along with photography and wildlife viewing, then that's a great destination.
And now what about Alaska? Tell us about your tours to Alaska.
Well, Alaska is another location that's close and easy to get to. And, we have our own Serengeti right here in the United States, and that is Alaska. So there's nothing like the open spaces up there. I've been leading bear trips up there for over 10 years. And so this is a brown bear excursion where we're out, on foot, hiking and photographing the feeding brown bears. They're feeding on salmon in August on the different rivers in Alaska. So it's another thrilling, large carnivore photography adventure. But once again, we're staying on a boat and it's amazing food and, catching our own halibut and king crab and not much roughing it there either. I guess I'm getting older, Mimi, so I don't want to rough it either. So I like to go to destinations that we can, have a nice place to stay and good food and enjoy each other's company and still get out and see wildlife.
Well, you're definitely a people person, so I can see how you would have fun leading these tours. For those of you who just tuned in, this is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, East County Magazine, and this is Mimi Pollack, and I'm talking to wildlife photographer Roy Tuft. Now, what would you say for when you take your people on these tours to Africa, Costa Rica, Alaska, Chile? Tell me 2 tips to be able to do successful wildlife photography.
2 tips. I think the first thing is patience. When we go out with wildlife, it's not like going to a studio or going to the zoo or where things are just going to perform for you. So I really, you know, I have to set expectations for my clients that we're going to extremely rich areas for wildlife, but there's still an element of being patient. The animals aren't there to please you or entertain you. We're just going in their environment, and obviously I'm taking people to very productive areas where we're going to see some great stuff. But, you know, just be happy to be there. And, you know, and that's my job, is to get you in the right spot at the right time and to have wonderful wilderness experiences.
Nice. Is there a website people can go to find out more information?
Sure. My website is toftphoto.com. So my last name, T-O-F as in Frank, T, photo, P-H-O-T-O.com. And, you know, you can get on there. I have lots of different links to photography and wildlife. I actually have a tours and workshops page, so you want to get on there to see where I'm going, what I'm doing, and feel free to shoot me an email.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And if you would like more information about Roy, look for my article that's coming up in East County Magazine. This is Mimi Pollack of Animal Tales. Thank you very much.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
This is Mark Clements.
And this is Cody Clements.
Working hard to bring you the wildest jobs in East County. Today, Cody and I went to Lakeside. There we met a man who's going to explain why his workday is more interesting than yours, or at least more likely to end up in a trip, to the hospital. I'm here today with Kevin Higley, who is a rodeo clown. Kevin, how long have you been doing rodeo clowning?
Ooh, that's a dated question, huh? You're going to make me tell how old I am is what you're trying to get at, right? No, I've been actually a professional rodeo clown for 30 years. Prior to that, I participated in high school rodeo and as a contestant, and then I started doing what we call amateur rodeos as a rodeo clown bullfighter, and then I got my pro card and went on to the professional ranks. And so I've been it for, I bet you, total almost 35 years.
So you were doing professional rodeo as what prior to doing the clown part of it?
I was, I tried to be a bull rider. Thought maybe I could make a profession out of it and a living. Wasn't very good at that. So what it came to be was my brother was a really good bull rider, and we had what they call a practice pen at home where we buck some bulls and stuff. And so we took turns being the bullfighter who would save the bull rider. Well, boy, I saved him a whole lot more than he ever thought of saving me. And so it became apparent that I was probably a little bit more adapted to the bullfighting area and saving the cowboys. And that was really the love and passion that I had once I got started, that, you know, the thrill of saving a guy so you can get on to another one is really something else. And as time went on, of course, you slow down a couple steps. Not me, but my mind may. I don't know. But anyway, so then I transferred into the rodeo clown / barrel man type aspect of the professional rodeo deal.
Now, you use the term bull fighting, which seems more appropriate to me somehow. So here's another question for you. I've noticed that bulls don't seem to have a lot of sense of humor. So have you actually made one ever laugh?
Oh, yeah, they're always smiling when they run over you. Yeah, well, they've got a smile. You know, a lot of people, they used to say that a bull will actually close his eyes before he runs over you. But that's not true. I can attest to that. They're wide open, and they are laughing. It's like, I got you, buddy. It's good.
So the natural follow-up to that is, how many bones have you had broken?
That's one we don't like to discuss very much. But, you know, I've been really fortunate in my career to stay away from most of the broken bones. I fractured a couple neck vertebrae, and I've had a couple of bones in my foot broke and a couple of things like that. But as a whole, I've been really healthy and really good.
Do you really like to use the word whole when you're talking about bulls and horns and stuff like that?
Yeah, that's kind of, you got to watch that one. Put you in a hole.
Now, I'm sure that people, not necessarily associated with rodeo, but people on the outside probably think that you would do this for the thrills. What kind of satisfaction do you get from actually doing this work?
That's a great question. You know, like I said early on, is just the satisfaction that you did something to help somebody else to be able to further their career and go on and stuff. So saving a bull rider from a bull, or helping him, assisting him to be a higher score, that's where it starts. And that now it's the thrill of entertainment, you know, making people laugh. I just love to hear them giggle and laugh. And so that part is where I'm at now in my career. So we do it for the love, because, you know, unlike a lot of professional sports, the money isn't probably as good as your football, your baseball, your basketball players, but it also is an aspect of it. We do it for the money as well.
Yeah, so you're as a professional rodeo, I see that you have a big trailer, so you travel around from rodeo to rodeo?
I do. Throughout the course of this year, I'll probably be in at least 15 states. I guess the farthest away, which my trailer wasn't able to go with me and a lot of my animals wasn't, was Hawaii. We've actually did rodeos in Hawaii on two of the islands over there.
Oh, really? So you did go to Hawaii, but you just didn't float your trailer across?
No, trailer stayed home as well as my animals that I use in my clown acts, yeah.
Okay, so you do an act out on the in the arena with your own animals. I see you have a dog over there. Is that one of your?
Yeah, I've actually got three or four dogs, and I've got a trick horse, trick mule. You know, sometimes the kids become my tricks. You know, I'm very enthusiastic about getting the crowd involved, and so we use the kids a lot of times in some of the things we do.
If I ever were to find myself in a field with a pissed off bull, because, you know, that happens to me a lot. Give me some ideas for how to sort of distract the guy.
Well, you know, so the best thing to do is, of course, it's not all about how fast you can outrun them. It's about the move that you can make to get around them. Because they've got a big old body and they got to bend in half to get to back to where you are. So what you want to do is you want to kind of get in as close as possible and then make that move to the inside and keep them coming. And then when you get to break, you break them so they're on a different lead and you can get away from them.
So you have to fight every instinct, natural instinct, to turn around and run. You have to get close to them, right next to them, in order to be safe.
You're sure better off. Yeah, you're better off. I mean, I know that my legs have never stood around for my face to take a beating, you know. And so it's kind of a natural instinct to run, yes. But, you know, there's a lot of different things you use. The apparel that we wear, the things we wear that gets their attention, that will bring them in your direction, and then it's up to you to make the move to bring them away from the cowboy and to get yourself away.
Okay. Now, professional football players, you mentioned them. They're always complaining about having a short career. Now, you've been doing this for a while. How long would you say the average rodeo clown sort of stays in the profession?
You know, and I guess that would be a term that's kind of tough to use, average, because I don't know any of us that are too, you know. And I guess the guy that kind of I look up to and kind of was my mentor, taught me a little bit, was a guy by the name of Wick Path. And he actually fought bulls at an active level, professional level, till he was 57 years old. It's all about how physically fit you stay. We've got a guy in the business right now that's strictly entertainment. He doesn't even get in the barrel anymore or do any of those things to help out. And he's 78 years old and very active and doing a great job.
Okay, well, see, my son here is, let's say that he goes to see his guidance counselor at school, and the guidance counselor, I've noticed, doesn't have any posters on the wall of rodeos or anything.
No.
But let's say that she says that she's changed her mind and he should forget about engineering and all of that, and he should become a rodeo clown. What advice would you give him for getting into this job, apart from, why don't you do something safe like join the Navy SEALs?
Yeah, there we go. Two safe jobs. Well, I'll tell you what the first thing I would do with modern day rodeo, we have schools, and the best thing to do for someone that's inspiring to be a rodeo clown or a bullfighter or a participant, a contestant, is to search out one of those schools and go spend a week, 3 days, whatever the school is, and actually get a head start on what they really could do and if they're adapted for that.
Do you know of any women who do this job who are rodeo clowns?
You know, there used to be, years ago, there was a lady that actually didn't actually do the bullfighting part of the clown, but she got in the barrel and she would tell a few jokes and do stuff. But that was a long time ago. Right at this present time, I don't know anybody, any ladies. I think it has to do with intelligence.
Oh, okay. That's an excellent point. Cody, you have a question?
Yeah, what's the deal with the barrels? What exactly do you do with barrels?
Okay, the barrel is out there for a particular reason. We had put it out in the middle of the arena, actually not quite the middle of the arena, it's a little closer to the bucking chutes, and it really becomes kind of like a safe haven for the bullfighters or the bull riders. In case that bull is coming at them, they're caught out in no man's land, they can come there, catch their breath, get away, or at least the bull will be distracted so they can move on. It's my job as a barrel man to position my barrel in a place which will help assist the bullfighters and the bull rider to be able to have a little bit more safety. So, and it's really like sitting in a washing machine just waiting for somebody to turn that thing on, the spin cycle. Because when one of those guys hits it, it can really turn your world upside down.
So it sounds like your job is more about strategy than it is about, I mean, obviously on YouTube or on TV, what they like to show is rodeo clowns being tossed and trampled and all that. But the object is to avoid that and to protect the cowboys and to entertain the crowd, basically, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a given that you're going to be in a very bad situation most of the time because, you know, you've got an unpredictable animal. He's going to do what he wants to do. He's going to do this. So you're going to be put in a position where you're going to get in there that you're probably going to get what they call hooked and thrown out of there. But the better that you prepare yourself to be able to make yourself in the right position to walk away from that, the longer your career will be.
So you're kind of like the ninjas of the West, is what you're telling me.
I never had it put that way, but yeah, cowabunga, dude, let's do it.
Okay, Cody?
So is it true about bulls that they don't like red, like don't like red capes? Is that true?
Great question. You know, and it really is a myth. That's it doesn't have to do with the red cape that the matadors, you see if the matadors are fighting, or like in our case, we wear bandanas a lot of times on our deals. It's all about the movement. It's the movement of something that brings their attention to it. And that's why when you see the guys with the capes and the matadors, and they can stand in one spot, but the bull will follow the cape and follow that deal.
Is there anything else you'd like to say to the people of East County?
Boy golly, if they get a chance, come to the rodeo. They're going to enjoy it.
So, Cody, now that you've seen a little bit of what life as a rodeo clown is like, are you ready to reconsider your future?
No, because as much as my counselors say that I should quit any field that involves thinking, I think I should steer clear of this kind of career.
Are you saying that you don't want to get involved in something that can cow you this much?
You know, I have a lot of beef with you saying something that mean about me, Dad.
Well, I would say that right now my attitude is the lasso your problems.
I just don't know if I'm capable of learning the ropes on this exciting career.
Well, son, that sounds like a lot of bull to me because I don't know anyone who clowns around as much as you do. This is Mark Clements.
And this is Cody Clements.
Clocking out of one of the wildest jobs in East County.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.